Once a month, my dogs get a box filled with special surprises. Inside are two or three healthy treats and two or three unique dog toys. I'm talking about BarkBox. Starting at $21 a month for the big dog box, BarkBox delivers a box full of joy right to my front door. You can get a one-month subscription, which is one BarkBox, six-month or 12-month subscriptions. Shipping is free inside the contiguous United States. When you're a new subscriber and use our special link, BarkBox.com/GreyhoundNJ, BarkBox will donate $25 to Greyhound Friends of New Jersey. Remember, BarkBox.com/GreyhoundNJ. Treat your dog while helping a greyhound still waiting for a home. Welcome to About Greyhounds, the podcast about
greyhounds.
Right. This is Jacqueline Howard of Greyhound Friends of New Jersey.
And I'm Al Cavallo.
Also of Greyhound Friends
of New Jersey.
Right. So today we are going to talk about a topic that our adopters sometimes reach out to about because they need help with it, and that is separation anxiety. So when a greyhound retires and is adopted, it's the first time that they're not with other greyhounds, unless there's another greyhound or more than one other greyhound in the home that they go to. Think about it. They have never, ever been alone. When they're puppies, they're in a kennel with other puppies and other greyhounds, adult greyhounds. When they go to training, they're with other puppies going through their training. And then when they're ready to go to the track, they're at the racetrack and the kennel's there with what? A bunch of other greyhounds. So again, they have never been alone. Well, greyhounds, you know, they're pretty laid back, most of them anyway. And most of them adjust to new environments and schedules pretty quickly. It never ceases to amaze me, actually, how quickly they can adapt. And a lot of them, even when they're the only dogs in the home, adjust very quickly. But sometimes a dog will have anxiety about the drastic change of being around so many dogs and now either being an only dog or just being in this entirely new environment. And they really don't like to be left alone. And this can escalate into some different things, like a lot of crying and barking when you're not home, or even some destructive behavior.
I think this is also something that we've experienced early on when we first started fostering. It's when, after the first few dogs, it's something that cropped up very early. And like you said, there's a lot of adopters that have the same questions. You know, what is my dog going to do when he or she's alone? They've never been alone. And you know, this is, you know, always a question in the adopter's mind.
Right. So what Al referred to is one of our fosters. We were probably, what do you think, Al, about three or four fosters in?
It was about that.
At this time. So we were relatively new to fostering at the time. We had had greyhounds for well over 10 years by then of our own. And as a matter of fact, our first one had separation anxiety, but it wasn't that bad of a case, if I remember that right. Well, except
it could be rose-colored glasses on that
maybe,
one.
Maybe it's rose-colored glasses. Yeah, in the beginning, we had created him as per the adoption group we got him from. And he chewed up many, many expensive beds that were in his crate. I remember that.
He bent the crate?
He bent the steel crate with his teeth.
And he ate the wallboard.
Oh, that's right. And the crate was right up against the wall, which really was just sheetrock and, you know, painted sheetrock. And somehow, I'm not sure how, but somehow he ate that wall while in the crate. It's funny now, right, Al? So, and what they told us at the time was, well, take the bedding out of the crate. And that would have meant, as I brought up to them, well, then he's going to be on a hard surface. They said, well, that'll teach him. So we did that for maybe a day. And then we said, you know what?
We didn't have much help.
FYI, that our first greyhound, who we love very much, was not from Greyhound Friends of New Jersey. Let's just point that out. And we had adopted him in 2000, actually, so quite some time ago. So eventually, or after that first day when we tried him in the crate without any bedding, we said, you know, that's just not something we want to do.
We're going to go without the crate for a
bit. We'll go without the crate. And we went without the crate, and I think initially we may have muzzled him so that he couldn't, you know, hurt himself or break anything and or chew up anything. And eventually he was fine. He actually
did really well.
And it turns out he was an only dog for about 6 years before we adopted our second greyhound. And by then, he really enjoyed being an only dog, so he wasn't too happy with the young whippersnapper we brought in. But that was okay. Eventually, everybody got along, and they became friends. Anyway, so removing bedding, not the way to go about it. And when we had this foster that had tremendous separation anxiety, I mean, it was horrific. He would scream in that crate, if I remember right, and
yes,
you know, it was
nonstop,
nonstop. So at the time, Heidi Garrett was a board member at Greyhound Friends of New Jersey, and she was also quite valuable for many reasons. One of which was that she is a dog behaviorist, and for foster families, I should say, and foster people. We used her as a resource whenever there was some kind of behavior issue. So we called Heidi and we said, Heidi, what do we do?
We need help.
Desperately. So she gave us several ideas and instructions. And I will tell you, everything she said to us sounded insane. Right?
It seemed so counterintuitive. Like, as we're listening to her, and, you know, explaining what we had to do, we were like, is this going to work?
Yeah, we were pretty sure it wouldn't. But Al and I are not dog trainers.
No.
We're certainly not dog behaviorists.
No.
We know greyhounds, and we're greyhound experienced, and even more so now that we've been fostering for about 4 years. We're getting close to 100 fosters at this point, so now we're a bit more well...
jaded.
Informed. We're a bit more well informed. Thanks for finishing my sentence, Al. We're a bit more well informed about greyhound behavior, but of course some things still come up where I need to, you know, contact some of the experts, my fellow board members, and ask them what I should be doing about something. But back to separation anxiety. So everything Heidi said to us sounded just so counterintuitive and wrong. But at least we had the smarts enough to know we are not the experts. Heidi is. We will do what she says to the T. We will follow those instructions quite carefully, and we did. So one of the first things that she told us was that the dog really needed to feel like he was part of our pack. So we had moved his crate, which had been in our bedroom, down to our formal living room, because of course the formal living room is where our dogs hang out. Where else would they be but in the fancy living room?
Yes.
But that is one of their main rooms, because of course their couches, not our couches, their couches are in there. So we moved the crate to the living room, in between the two couches, which are on opposite side of the rooms facing each other. And during the day while we're at work, our greyhounds sleep on those couches, so the foster could see those dogs, and he wasn't truly alone, although he was crated and they were not. He was crated for a couple of reasons. The first reason is Greyhound Friends of New Jersey foster guidelines say to foster, sorry, not to foster, say to crate the fosters when we're not home. Secondly, it's for his own safety and for the safety of our dogs and for the cats, because, of course, we'd only had the dog for, just a few days. We didn't really know the dog, so, of course, we weren't going to let him roam freely. So that was one of the first things we did, made him feel like part of the pack by moving the crate into, we'll call it
a common area.
The formal living room, a.k.a. the dog room, so he didn't feel so alone. The other thing to make him feel like part of a pack that we did was, of course, to let him sleep in our room at night, which he was doing anyway, but because he was crated during the day while we were at work, we didn't want to crate him again at night. You know, that's just too much time in the crate. So we didn't crate him at night, but Heidi told us, make our bedroom a big crate. Now, how did we do that?
By just simply closing the door.
Right,
closed it off, and then now our bedroom became the giant crate with the whole pack, including us, in the room.
In the bedroom, right. So I said to Heidi, when she said, you know, put the crate in the living room, and while we're at work or, you know, going out to dinner or wherever we are, I told her, yeah, I'm putting him in there and he can see the dogs and he's part of a pack, but, you know, he's still whining about it. And, he still didn't like being in the crate and he didn't like that we weren't home.
Yeah.
So she told us to do this exercise as many times as needed to get him to be calm.
Calm and submissive.
And what that thing was to put him in the crate and walk away. And as soon as he started whining, which in his case was immediately, we looked at him. We were probably how many feet away?
At that point, not even a few feet. It was like immediately. So as soon as we turned, he was crying. So we would turn, as Heidi instructed.
Point at him.
And with a firm, hey, just a hey. And then point at him. And then, and with that correction, to see if his ears went back into a submissive, or until he either laid down or was in a submissive standing position and quiet.
Right. So, as you can imagine, and as I said, this foster, let's call him Bob. I don't want to give his real name to protect the innocent, because he was cured. So Bob, his case was, really bad. So we would put him in the crate and we'd turn. And as soon as he started crying, we turned back around to face him, point at him, and say, hey! And we would stand there, pointing, not saying another word, until he went into a submissive pose. Mostly that was laying down. And as soon as he, let's say, laid down, we'd turn our back, slowly walk away. He'd start whining. We'd turn again, point, hey! Keep pointing until he went into a submissive position. Again, in his case, laying down. This would take a while to do. But that's what we did. And it got to the point where we could walk out of the room. Maybe half a minute would go by. Then he'd start whining. We would march right in there, point, say, hey! Still pointing at him until he lay down. And then we would walk away. So we did this exercise. It was a weekend. I remember that. It was a Saturday or a Sunday, so we weren't at work. So we just did this again and again. And each time we did it, he would go
a little longer each time. It was, so, that that process just built up, you know, minute by minute, essentially. But with each correction and knowing, and then him knowing that it was, you know, that we were coming back.
Right, right. And what Heidi told me was that the reason we use this method of crate training is to really teach the dog to have a calm state of mind when in the crate. So instead of being all agitated, we get him to calm down. And he's not so much associating that crate with the
anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. And the whining and crying and everything else. So the other thing Heidi told us to do, and this is where it seems really wrong, was to not give Bob any affection. None. Now, you have an anxious dog. And Al, what's the first thing we wanted, we don't do it anymore, but wanted to do that most people want to do when a dog is worried and scared?
You want to hug him. You want to comfort him. You want to, you Bob this, Bob that, Bob it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And fawn over him.
You want to fawn all over him. You want to hold him and tell him, it's okay, baby, don't worry. But they're not children. They're dogs. And we have to remember that. So, Heidi said, don't give him affection. And I thought, well, this is crazy talk, but she's the expert. I'm not. I'm going to do that. And let me tell you, it's hard. We know it's hard. We want, you know, especially as parents, you know, we have that paternal and maternal instinct to comfort, but do not comfort the dog who is showing anxiety. It will feed into it and make matters even worse. The other thing that Heidi told us with crate training when we were ready to actually
leave the house,
not fake leaving or having a training exercise. And this actually did make a lot of sense to me. She said, crate the dog about 15 to 20 minutes before we were going to leave the house. Again, that is about 15 or 20 minutes before leaving the house. So we've put the dog in the crate. We have probably gone through a few pointing and haze
sessions, and we've gone that far. So right. Now we're actually leaving the house.
And the other thing, when you're putting the dog in the crate, don't talk to the dog. Don't talk to the dog at all.
You go there with a purpose. You get, you know, guide, you know, some may or may not feel comfortable going into the crate, but, you know, just a firm guidance into the crate. Don't talk to him. Don't pet him. Don't say good dog. Just nothing. Just bring him to the crate, close it, walk away as per the other exercises. To the point now, this is like 15, 20 minutes before you're going to leave. Go about your business.
Go about your business. Don't talk to him. Don't look at him. You're going to want to. If you're anything like us, do not do it. Just ignore the dog. Everything is going along as it should be. That needs to be the expectation. That needs to be the vibe you're giving off. And if you have anxiety or if you are nervous or show that anxiety, even in the least bit, the dog will see it.
They pick up on it. They sense it.
He'll see right through you. Yeah. And that's going to feed the anxiety. So stay calm. Oh, there's one of our dogs now. Sounded like Baron. Again, we have a studio, but it is not soundproof. And our dogs are right outside. And sometimes they walk around and sometimes they demand something of us. But we're busy. So, where were we, Al?
We're back to leaving the house.
Back to leaving the house. So, again, 15, 20 minutes before you leave the house, this is after you have done, if necessary, the pointing and firm hay to get him to be submissive. Go about your business. Ignore the dog. When you back up a little, when you've put the dog in the crate, no talking. There's no need to talk. Put him in the crate. Close the door. Walk away, do your haze and pointing if you have to, then go about your business. Do not acknowledge that dog unless he starts whining. And then what would we do, Al?
Then we do the correction again.
Again. And listen, this takes some patience, especially if it's a bad case like Bob was.
Yeah, it's not going to be overnight.
But keep it up. Believe me, unless there is something, what would the word be, cognitively wrong with the dog, this will work.
This will work.
We've done this many, many times since Bob, and believe me, it works. So, what about when you come home, Al? What did we do? Do you remember when we came home? We wouldn't let him out right away.
Right. So you get home, don't let him out right away, but it's not nearly, I don't think it's not necessarily the, 10, 15 minutes. He's not sitting there because depending how long you've been out, he might have to actually to go about his business. So, but get home, not instantly, but then they're taken out of the crate. And without a big deal. Again, no talking, no, oh, happy to see you, give me a hug. No, nothing. Just out, do the business, it becomes the routine, no big deal.
Right, exactly. So.
And especially if they're, he wasn't a hyper dog when we got home.
No.
No.
No, but he would get excited when we got home because he,
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to feed that.
No.
So they're maniacs when you get home.
Yeah. So, use your common sense. If the dog has been crated for long enough where he or she needs to go for a walk or go in your fenced yard, whichever it is, to do his or her business, then of course, don't make the dog wait if the dog needs to relieve him or herself. But if it makes sense, maybe you get home, you're home for about 10 minutes, walking by the dog, not looking at the dog, not talking to the dog. And the other thing is, and a lot of people do this, they come home and the dogs are excited to see them. And I know I'm always happy to see my dogs when I get home from a long day at work. The people feed right into the dog's excitement. Oh, hey, how are you? So good to see you. Oh, I love you. I love you. And this is building up a frenzy in the dog. You don't want to do that. Of course, you're happy to see them. But and unless you like a really hearty welcome every day where it's out of control, don't do that. Just come home and be calm. And with a dog with separation anxiety, absolutely do not do that because you're feeding into, I'm home, it's exciting, look at me, oh, this is great, we're together again. And that really, really is not good for a dog suffering with separation anxiety. So again, come home if it's at all possible based on the dog's schedule for doing his or her business. Go about your business in the house for about 10 minutes. Do not talk to the dog. Do not look at the dog. If the dog starts whining, of course, do the pointing, do the hey, until the dog is submissive. Then go about your business again. Repeat if necessary. When it is time to take the dog out, if it's to go for a walk, don't say a word. Take the dog out of the crate. Put the dog's leash on. Take the dog for the walk, or if you're putting the dog out in the yard, take the dog by his or her collar, bring him to the door.
Calmly guide him.
Calm,
so if you have laminate flooring or tile and stuff, that they're not doing the ice capades across the
The ice capades, that's a good one, Al. Yeah.
But everything is calm and part of the routine and nothing out of the ordinary.
Right, and don't talk to them. There's no conversation. Not for a dog with separation anxiety. And put them outside. So, speaking of walks, another idea that Heidi gave us was to take Bob for power walks. So what this is, these aren't the walks that you would normally go on for the dog to relieve him or herself. These are power walks specifically to help the dog with the separation anxiety. And what it is, go out for about 10 minute, a few 10 minute walks where you walk like you mean business. So you're not walking slow. It's not a pleasure walk. You're not on your daily constitutional. You are on a power walk. Like, you are walking at a good brisk, pace, a brisk pace with the dog on the leash. Do not talk to the dog. Just go for your power walk and come back home. Do this a few times a day, about 10 minutes each time. Maybe you're walking around your block one or two times. Mm-hmm. The reason for this, Heidi said, is that a quick power walk, it's really a mental exercise that helps the dog focus on you and nothing else in the environment. So if he gets distracted by something, correct him. This is when you can talk. Correct him by, like, how would you do it? Yeah. Say it, pulling the leash closer and, hey.
Might be another podcast.
Well, I'm walking, but this is really
the Linda Wyman walking routine.
Right. But this is really, Al, just a podcast episode about separation anxiety.
But I digress.
So we'll stick with that. So when you're walking the dog, you're going for 10 minutes. It's all about you. If the dog gets distracted, oh, there's another dog. Oh, there's a rabbit. Oh, there's a leaf.
It's a short correction pulled toward the hip, not up.
Pulling the leash towards your hip.
It's just a quick tug. It's just enough to get their attention to say, hey, nope, we're doing this. Not doing what you're doing. You're doing what I'm doing, which is walking.
Right. And again, don't let the dog get distracted. You are in charge. Keep that in your head. You know, some people are leaders and they walk like this anyway. Yeah. Other people, you know, just like our dogs, there's some that don't like taking a leadership position. But with a dog, a greyhound or any dog breed, you are the leader. You need to be in that leader position. And again, what this is really a mental exercise. And where you are basically forcing the dog just to focus on you and nothing else. And I mean nothing. And what this does is it gets the dog to understand that you're taking charge, like I said. And he's getting the message, hey, I don't have to take charge. This will actually relax the dog. Because they really, they want you to be their leader. It makes them feel more secure. So when you're doing this power walk, again, a few times a day, the dog is really forced to follow you and your lead.
Yeah, because it's like you mentioned, it's not about relieving themselves. It's not about anything else. They're only going because you're going for a walk, which then, like you said, puts you in charge. They have to follow you.
Yeah. Yeah. So instantly you're the leader and you keep doing this. They will recognize you again and again as the leader. Once they trust you as the leader, see you in that alpha position, they will know that you're in charge. They'll feel more secure. And when you leave to go to work or go shopping or wherever you're going, of course you're going to come back. You're the leader. That's what's going through their mind. It's a matter of training their minds to realize this. So, Al, I'm going to now get to the hardest thing that Heidi told us to do. I mean, this is hard. And I touched on it a little. You touched on it a little in some of the other techniques that we implemented with Bob. And that is to ignore the dog. Now, that doesn't mean, and when I say this, people look at me like, oh my gosh, that's just so mean. I don't mean, like, don't feed him. Don't take him for a walk.
No.
that's not what I mean at all. Because of course you do these things for the dog. You're taking, you are the dog's leader. So you provide the food and you provide the water and you provide the walks. And you are the one that opens the door to let them in the fenced in yard if you have that.
Yeah. And it's, and by supplying all that, it's also, you as the alpha. It's not you as, or it's not them as the alpha saying, hey, I want food, or hey, I want water, or hey, I want you to be home. It's the reversal. You are dictating all these issues. So, yeah, go.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, ignore the dog. That means no eye contact. Of course, like I said, feed them, walk them. If you have a fenced yard, let them out. No coddling, no loving on them, no petting them. If the dog comes to you to be petting and, oh, this is so hard, say no and lift up your hand. Because a lot of them, they do this thing like where they'll actually come up to you and put their head under your hand so that you know, you're in the petting position, all primed and ready to go. No. You say no and do this for a few days. It is extremely hard. And I'll tell you what, we did this with Bob for about 3 days.
Yeah, at least.
And we did all those other things we talked about all within like a 3-day period. Again, this was a dog who had some serious separation anxiety. By the 4th day, Bob was cured of his separation anxiety. It was that fast. No one was more shocked than us. Because again, as Heidi is instructing us on all these things we needed to do, we're thinking this is crazy talk, you know, like this is not going to work. But again, we were smart enough to realize, well, we're not the professionals. Let's give this a try, because she is. And now we're sharing this with you. And I will tell you, Al and I, what would you say, every 2 to 3 weeks we get one or two fosters?
Yeah, I did spend, yeah, every 2 weeks or so, yeah, one or two fosters. And that is, since that time, we've taken the exact same steps for every foster that's come in. It works. It's consistent. It's our routine. The dogs, and I think even Heidi touched on it, is like, you know, they've come from a kennel environment with almost like minimal contact at time, right? So they're used to the kennel, and by giving them the affection, and then it's flipping that to where they're the alpha and then you're lower on the totem pole. And then it just feeds into all this anxiety and the separation anxiety and
low confidence.
And by doing all these steps, it puts you in charge. It calms the dog. Everything's normal. This is the routine.
Right.
And it like you said, it works within, you know, days.
Yeah. And like you said, Al, you know, we bring in fosters for the last 4 years, every 2 to 3 weeks, we bring in one or two fosters at a time. And listen, most of those dogs don't have separation anxiety. They don't come to us that way. Yeah. Most. Like I said, once in a while, there are some that do have it. But regardless, if they have it or not, we establish our leadership in our home for those dogs. For all the reasons you just set out, you know, to help the dog with his confidence so the dog recognizes us as the leaders. We also have kids, school-age kids. They do the same, and they're used to this this routine. And it really helps. It really does. Like, we really haven't had, I think, in a lot, like, since Bob, we had maybe, I'm guessing maybe two that had serious separation anxiety that we were able to
work through.
Now, are there dogs that have such severe separation anxiety that it can't be worked through? I would say, yeah, that that probably does happen. In those cases, it could be, I think it's more than just a behavior or a lack of confidence. I think, and I'm not a doctor, but just based on our experience and in talking to just so many people about their greyhounds and other dogs, that, you know, it could be something chemical with the dog. So on the off chance that these techniques don't work for the dog, you know, definitely talk to your vet about it, because maybe it's something that can be handled with medication. But more often than not, just like people, it's something psychological that that can be addressed with these steps. They're not easy because some of them are so repetitive, and some of them, again, as we said in the beginning,
patience.
It does take patience, especially in the beginning with the crate and the hay and the pointing. That does take a lot of time and patience, but certainly it is worth it. You know, one of the things that Heidi said to us was that at Greyhound Friends, we sometimes ask new adopters to hold back on affection because most anxiety is really brought on by people giving the dog too much affection at a time when the dog is really unsure of his new environment. I mean, really what we need to remember, especially with retired racing greyhounds, is that these are dogs that, as we said earlier, have been with other dogs in a very scheduled, regimented environment for their entire lives. They have been handled by professionals. For the most part, they're not being treated like members of the family. They're co-workers, really. It's a working relationship they have with their trainers and the other professionals who handle the dogs at their kennel when they're puppies and in training, and then later on at the kennels at the racetrack. So a lot of attention and focus the first few days or even week is sometimes interpreted by the dog, whether greyhound or not, as a weakness in the person. So they are not seeing this as something nice, like if you're cuddling them or kissing them or petting them or fawning them, oh, don't worry, baby. You know, they think that's weak. They don't look at that as something nice. So they remember, like, they're a dog and need to look at it from their perspective. So, as I said, keep in mind that greyhounds have lived in that kennel environment. They felt very secure in those environments, and they knew what to expect because, again, everything is regimented, very routine. Occasionally, they get a good dog or a pat on the head, but never, ever were these dogs the center of attention. So sometimes adopters unknowingly put the dog in the leadership position by showering them with the affection and attention, when really the dog would feel better if he or she was given the space and time to observe the new surroundings. So show the dog the boundaries so his focus is really
on you.
On you. Exactly. So a couple of other things that you can do if you're going out. Give the dog, while he's in the crate, you can give him some busy work. Sometimes the dog just needs a job. Now, here's what I mean by that. You could take, for instance, a Kong. Get a few Kongs, actually. Fill them up with peanut butter and then freeze them. Believe me, the dog will be focused on that for quite some time. They never seem to bore of that. Don't give your dog too much peanut butter because, well, you know why, Hal. The dog will be bound up. Never a good or pleasant experience for anybody. So, you know, one Kong filled with peanut butter is probably enough. Make sure it's not too small a Kong. You don't want the dog to choke on it. Yeah. Make sure it's a big...
Use common sense.
Yeah, a big Kong. you know, put some peanut butter in there and freeze it. I'm telling you, your dog will have some busy work for a while. If all else fails, you've tried all of these techniques. You have given it some time. Maybe you've even talked to your vet. Call us. Call Greyhound Friends of New Jersey. Reach out. Yeah, one of the great things about Greyhound Friends of New Jersey, and you'll hear me say this a lot, is that it's an extremely supportive organization. And if you're having an issue or just have a question, we support the greyhounds adopted from our agency and our adopters for the life of that greyhound. So of course, reach out to us and ask the question. Generally, people seem to like to go on Facebook a lot with behavior issues. That's fine, but really, I would say reach out to the organization first. You know, someone on the board, and ask them for guidance. I would say before going on social media, because you'll get some good advice, you'll get some interesting advice, and you may get some not so good advice. So again, nothing terribly wrong with asking on social media, but
an email or a phone call away.
Yeah,
first, like, and then
yeah,
and go from there.
And if you haven't adopted from Greyhound Friends of New Jersey, please, you know, reach out to your organization. Most organizations that do greyhound adoption and rehoming are supportive, and we care very much about our dogs, the ones that are currently in our care and the ones who have gone on to their retirement in their adoptive homes. Speaking of posting behavior issues in a Facebook group, I'm reminded of a story about one of Greyhound Friends of New Jersey's adopters. I'll call her Anne. So Anne adopted, actually, one of my fosters about 4 years ago. And I remember the dog because he was really, really pretty. And Anne and I are connected on Facebook. And, you know, I'm able to see pictures of the dog all the time. So because of that, I remember him very well. So Anne posted on Facebook that her and her husband had recently had a baby, which I knew, and all of a sudden, the dog, the greyhound that she had had for 4 years, was suddenly showing signs of separation anxiety, which is something he hadn't done before. As a matter of fact, he was a fairly confident dog before. So this story is kind of twofold, because it's about posting on social media with questions, how Greyhound Friends of New Jersey reacts, and also about something I call pressing the reset button for separation anxiety. So pressing the reset button is basically my way of saying the dog didn't have separation anxiety before, now he does. We have got to start from square one, which is going through all of the steps that Al and I have been talking about through this episode. So what Greyhound Friends of New Jersey does, when we see a post on our social media, be it Twitter or Facebook, and an adopter posts an issue that they're having, and it's a serious issue, we will definitely reach out to that person, usually privately, sometimes not privately, depending, to ask them to call us, because we'll, you know, we want to find out what's going on, get more details. We also don't want them getting wrong advice. So because I knew Anne, I sent her a message and I said, "Hey, saw your post. I can help you with this. Give me a call." So she did. And long story short, I asked her, you know, what had changed. Now, obviously, the baby is a big change going on in the family. But what they had done prior with their dog was made him the center of their attention. He was their baby. And, you know, they would cuddle with him, watch TV with him. He went everywhere with them. He had full run of the house. But then the baby came, and what they did was they gated off a portion of the house with baby gates so that the dog had one side of the house and the people had the other side, including the baby. So the dog could see everybody. He just couldn't get to them. He wasn't with them. Now, I fully support keeping a dog, especially a very big and powerful dog and fast dog like a greyhound, separate from infants. Not because greyhounds are aggressive. They certainly aren't, but they are dogs. So I am a firm supporter and practicer of keeping dogs and infants separate. However, what was happening in this case is the dog was away from his pack. He was separate from them. He could see them, but he's not really that involved with them. How could he be? He's basically behind a gate. The next thing that Anne had told me was that they just didn't have the time they did before to take him for those long walks that he really enjoyed and to cuddle with them on the couch or whatever it was that they were doing. So not that they completely stopped doing these things, but there wasn't as much time. And as a parent, I get that. The thing is, the dog was just crying all the time. Anne said it was driving her crazy. He just stayed on the other side of the gate and just cried. If he wasn't sleeping or eating, he was crying and barking and whining. And then he started getting a little destructive. So if he could pick something up, he would start chewing it. So the dog developed this anxiety, and she knew why. And, you know, it was obvious. He separated from his pack. So I had her hit the reset button and go through all the exercises that Al and I just went through. And I told her I'd call her in a few days to see how it was going. So I called her, and lo and behold, he wasn't cured, but he was well on his way to getting better. And we talked through again what she was doing. I asked her if she had any questions, and I told her I'd check in the next week and to keep doing what she was doing until he had stopped completely with the whining and crying and all of that. So I called her back a week later, and she told me they were still doing their power walks. They didn't have to do the haze and pointing anymore. They made special time for their dog. And guess what? He was much better. So now Anne knew what to do if this came up again and how to work toward preventing it from happening again. So it was just so great to be able to help her through that, because she was worried that it was just going to get to be too much, that she'd have to return her dog. And her and her husband did not want to do that. They loved the dog, but they knew he was miserable. But because they took the time and had the patience and the love to work with him and to listen to the guidance that they were getting, everybody's happy now, and the dog he's doing fantastic. So that's the story about the reset button. A few more things that I just want to touch on very quickly before we sign off. When you're correcting your dog, don't use the dog's name to correct him or her. So for example, let's say your dog's name is Fido. I know, not very original. And Fido starts counter surfing, meaning he's starting to jump up on your counters to grab things. Maybe there's a turkey up there thawing out or something, and he jumps up to grab it. You wouldn't say Fido to correct him. You would say, hey, or use some other term that has a hard vowel sound, like hey. Here's why. When I say Fido, I want him to do something. Usually that means I want him to come to me. If I'm using Fido when I'm correcting him, He's now associating that with being in trouble or doing something he shouldn't be doing, and that's going to confuse him. So when you're correcting the dog, use the same consistent word. If there's multiple people in your home, everybody needs to agree to use that word. Also, when you are correcting the dog, don't yell at them. Greyhounds are very, very sensitive, and being scolded with someone who's yelling at them really, really makes a lot of them super nervous and puts them out of sorts. They're just very sensitive that way. So there's nothing wrong with raising your voice and your voice being firm. So again, when I need to correct a dog, I say, hey, just like that. So it's louder, but I'm not screaming at the dog. I'm getting the dog's attention. The other thing I wanted to just touch on is that there are dogs who really can't be crated. And no matter how many times you point and say, hey, it's just not going to work. It's like, it's almost like people with a phobia, you know, to an elevator. You're just not getting them in an elevator. Well, there's some dogs that if you were to crate them, they would probably hurt themselves somehow. I could give you two examples from my dogs. So my first greyhound, his name was Max, and Elle and I had talked about him a little bit in the beginning of this episode. So Max had this terrible separation anxiety, and his crate, which we still have, it's made of steel. He wanted out of that crate so badly that while we were at work, when we first got him, he literally bent steel bars with his teeth. Now, this probably wouldn't kill him, but I'm surprised none of his teeth came out. So after that, as we mentioned, we said, okay, Max, no more crate. And then there's Baron. So Baron's a bit of a special case. Baron has or had some pretty intense anxieties. Not just separation, but a leaf would blow by and he'd be terrified. He was just very, very fearful and a high anxiety dog. He still has some anxieties now. We've had him for about 6 years, but he's much, much better. And when he's in the house, he is completely relaxed. I mean, he thinks he's king of the house, and he's just very, very comfortable here. But anyway, so when we got Baron, we put him in his crate initially when we went to work. Well, the first day we went to work, I put him in the crate. When I came home, he's out of the crate. He's just, you know, wandering around the house. And I went and looked at the crate, and sure enough, the door is closed on the crate. Nothing's amiss with the crate. So I start thinking, well, maybe I was just a little absent-minded this morning and thought I put him in there and then closed it. So I didn't think much about it. The next morning, I put Baron in his crate. I closed the door on the crate and latched it so that he's in there. He's not supposed to be able to get out. And I went to work. But that night, when I came home from work, he's out again. I look at his crate. It's still closed. So we figured out how he did it. And it was pretty dangerous what he did. Basically, it's a folding crate. And he had somehow, and it's really hard to describe, but pulled one of the walls toward him while he was inside of the crate and somehow squeezed himself out. And once he got out, it snapped right back into place. This was a super dangerous thing for him to do because he could have gotten his neck caught or any body part or been stuck. It just could have been really bad. So guess what? No more crate for Baron. So what did we do? Well, just like with Max, when we weren't home, he was muzzled and we And in Baron's case, we muzzled our other dog as well. When we first got Max, we didn't have another dog. So in the case where a dog just will not be in a crate, for some reason it's just impossible for the dog to be in the crate because it's too dangerous for that particular dog, muzzle the dog. The other thing you want to do is give him a closed off area from when you're not at home, so he's not like freely roaming around. Don't let him freely roam around until he's more comfortable in the house, and if that's what you want him to do as well. So you know, consider baby gates. There's all kinds of sizes and types that you could get. So you know, you might want to put gates in whatever common area there is in your house, so that you know, where he has access to a window so he can see what's going on, and provide him with a dog bed, of course, and muzzle, because you just don't want him chewing on anything if he's nervous or anxious, because that could damage him. When you adopt a dog, a greyhound, or really any dog, but a greyhound from Greyhound Friends of New Jersey, if the dog's been fostered, the person that fostered the dog will be able to tell you whether or not the dog has or had separation anxiety, what they did to address it, and what the outcome is. So let's say the outcome was that the dog was quote-unquote cured of the separation anxiety. Well, that doesn't mean that the dog is going to be cured when he or she gets to your home. Because what's happened? Well, another type of reset button's been set, because now the dog is in yet another new place with a new person or new people, different smells, different environment, different schedules. So guess what? Go through all the exercises that we talked about. And we tell this to adopters when they adopt any of our fosters, even the confident ones, because we don't want to see separation anxiety rear its ugly head, and we do not want the dog thinking he or she is in charge of us, like we talked about earlier in this episode. So again, go through these exercises where no eye contact, no affection. Do that for a few days and see how that goes. Thanks for listening to this podcast. This is Jacqueline Howard of Greyhound Friends of New Jersey.
And I'm Al Cavallo.
And this has been an About Greyhounds episode. Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Our separation anxiety is certainly a fairly big topic to tackle, and it can be a challenge to get through, but I promise you, if you adhere to the techniques that Elle and I just shared, you will make progress, and you should be able to help that dog, unless, of course, as we said earlier, it is something that is not behavioral, but rather something chemical that could possibly be addressed with medication. So do talk to your vet about that and let him or her know what's going on. At Greyhound Friends, we are here to support our adopters and their greyhounds for the life of those dogs. And that takes money between bringing the dogs to New Jersey, promoting the dogs, getting them adopted, taking care of the dogs, paying our vet bills, etc. If you've been enjoying the About Greyhounds series, or this is the first episode you've heard and you enjoy it, please consider donating to Greyhound Friends of New Jersey. There are two ways that you can do that. You can go to our website, gfnj.org, and click on the donate button at the top of the page, or you can click on the donate button on the About Greyhounds podcast website. It is aboutgreys.com. Click on donate. That will take you to another link that will get you into the Greyhound Friends New Jersey donation page. So thanks for listening, and I am looking forward to bringing you a new episode next week.